Business Associates. Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. Learn about Krannert Center's 2006-2007 performance season, including family performances of Ralph's World, the ballet Cinderella, and the Drummers of Burundi, by visiting KrannertCenter.com or browsing a season brochure.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for your regular host, David Inge. And David returns on Monday, by the way. Henry Frain is our technical director, and our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. Very glad you're listening today. During this hour of the show, we'll do something we do once a month, talk about personal finance. Our guest, David Sinno. He is our personal finance expert. He's been with us for a long time. He's a professor of finance at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and he has a wide-ranging background on all kinds of financial affairs. We'll begin by talking about a few issues and also welcome your calls on either those issues or anything in general with regard to money management, retirements, investments, your financial health. Questions are welcome on any of those topics. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us in the continental U.S., that is 800-222-9455. And as we proceed, I will give out those numbers again. But first, let's say hello to our guest, David Sinno.
Well, good morning, Jack. And as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. Well, it's certainly no secret that the U.S. stock market in the past 9 days is, well, shall we call it a bad cold. It seems to have caught a bad cold. Just a few short days ago, on May 10th, the Dow Jones Industrial Average seemed destined to break its all-time high of 11,723, which was really posted more than 6 years ago, around January 14th of 2000. But the market sell-off began with bad news on the inflation front. Wholesale inflation at the producer level shot up some 0.8% in April, and retail inflation, that consumer price index, increased some 0.6% as well. Now, it doesn't take a Philadelphia lawyer to figure out that stocks hate unexpected and bad news, especially on the inflation front. Maybe we should rename the inflation front the oil front. But in any event, this inflation data simply reignites the fear and belief that the Federal Reserve will continue to raise interest rates by raising the Fed funds rate, thereby making the cost of borrowing money higher, more expensive for everyone. Already, the Federal Reserve has boosted interest rates some 16 times over, call it about 2 years. The theory, of course, is that higher interest rates will slow a rapidly growing economy. Consumers like ourselves will think twice about borrowing more money and thereby curbing our purchases, perhaps, and slowing the economy just a bit, especially in the product and service sectors. Higher interest rates also mean that it's more expensive for corporations to borrow, thereby increasing their interest rate expenses and ultimately lowering their profitability. And of course, if we have corporations that are less profitable, people worry about their dividend checks. Are dividends going to be cut? Ultimately, investors then will think twice about buying stocks, further depressing stock prices. This now seems to be a common theme echoed on Wall Street, especially over about the last 2 weeks as these inflation numbers have come to the fore. Well, at the same time, interest rates in the CD market and the money market continue to move higher. National money market rates are moving toward that magic 5%, and there are many one-year CD rates in excess of 5%. As banks fight to hang on to their deposits. So additionally, we have something called the phenomenon of relative attraction. Namely, investors are asking themselves, perhaps I'd just be better off with an ironclad, guaranteed, safe return of 5% than subjecting myself to the whims of the stock market. Well, here's my response to these comments. One, if you're going to invest in stocks, as I continue to preach, you must think long term, essentially a minimum of 20 years and preferably 30 years. You need to adopt the Well, let's call it the mindset of a foundation or a pension fund, where investments are made from a long-term perspective. I really call this legacy investing. And when I teach my classes at the University of Illinois, I teach my students to think as legacy long-term investors. If you don't adopt a long-term philosophy, then you're going to get caught up in the emotion of last week, the emotion of this week, and you're going to buy when you're supposed to sell, and you're going to sell just about the time that you should be buying. So again, it makes sense to make a long-term commitment to the market. Then day-to-day and week-to-week and even month-to-month fluctuations really become, well, let's call it background noise. Point two, diversification really matters. It's imperative that your stock portfolio be broadly represented by most of the asset classes, both U.S.-based and globally based. For example, as you know, each month I highlight the results of my couch potato portfolio. That's right, I continue to sit on my couch, eat my potato chips, and in spite of the flack and consternation I receive from my lovely wife, Carol, who insists that I go out and exercise, I try to stay on that couch and eat my potato chips. Well, in spite of a very tough few days in the market, through yesterday's close, the couch potato portfolio is still up some 6.82% since January 1. Let's think about that. That return has been garnered in less than 5 months. We have a diversified portfolio of large companies and small companies, large value companies and small value companies, U.S.-based companies and international companies, as well as emerging markets, as well as the REIT index, the REIT, and the mid-caps as well. So it is broadly diversified. On the other hand, if your money was simply in the S&P 500 through yesterday's close, your portfolio, including dividends, had grown by about 1.78% since the beginning of the year. Part of the reason for the discrepancy is the fact that international markets continue to outperform U.S. markets, especially since the beginning of the year. For example, the Vanguard Total International Index and its emerging market fund as well are more than 11% ahead for the year. And in our couch potato portfolio, we have about 30% of our dollar going into these particular asset classes. Bottom line, diversification really does matter. Now, I'd like to address one other matter in my opening remarks. And this matter was brought to my attention recently by a former neighbor when I lived in Urbana, Illinois. She called me and said that her brokerage firm was initiating a major change in how they charged fees on her account. Basically, her firm would no longer charge any commissions for the purchase and sale of securities. In other words, they were going to move away from a transactionally based fee structure. Rather, the firm would begin charging a quarterly asset management fee based on the size of the portfolio. This change from a transactional-based fee to an asset-based fee is really becoming the norm of the industry. This change is especially evident among middle-tier brokerage firms. Now, if your financial advisor is indeed charging you a fee based on assets under management, the question arises, is there an industry standard for the fee charged? What is a fair fee? How much should that fee be? While there is no defined industry standard, it seems to me that a reasonable fee for managing an equity or stock portfolio should be in the range of 1% annually, maybe give or take a 0.25% higher or lower. So that would be about 0.25% at the end of each calendar quarter. That's what would be assessed as a fee on your particular account. And if your advisor is managing a fixed income portfolio, such as a laddered certificate of deposit portfolio, or a laddered bond or laddered municipal bond portfolio, I think an appropriate fee is in the range of 0.5% on an annualized basis. Fees over the long term do make a difference. For example, let's assume you began saving for your granddaughter's college education the moment she was born. You invested $300 every month into a stock portfolio, and you chose stock indexes as your investment vehicle. And over the course of the next 18 years, each month, you dollar cost averaged $300 into these positions, and your funds compounded over this period of time at 8%. The total value of your educational account at the end of 18 years would approximate $144,000, and maybe, just maybe, that might be enough to educate a child. Had you enlisted a professional manager to help you, which would also be very appropriate, let's assume the professional also earned 8% for you, but charged an annual 1% fee. So you really netted 7%. It doesn't sound like a big difference whether you earned 8 or 7 over this period of time, but your educational portfolio, instead of being worth $144,000, would be worth a little over $129,000, which is about 10% less during that period of time, even though your overall return of the two portfolios differed only by 1%. Here's the bottom line. Fees do make a difference, and often fees are negotiable with your manager, with your advisor, with your financial planner. So take a careful look at your fee structure. Don't be fearful. Do not be afraid to discuss it with your portfolio advisor. Well, there you have it, Jack. I'd be delighted to tackle questions on issues I've raised, or, of course, any other questions from our audience.
Okay. Well, we have several people waiting. Let me just mention that our guest is David Sino, professor of finance at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. We're taking your questions on personal finance, and we'll go right away to some Champaign listeners. I'll mention the phone number again if you don't have that handy, 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana, toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Champaign listener on line number one is first. Good morning.
Hi there. David?
Yes, good morning.
Good morning. I've always been interested in your couch potato portfolio. You talked about it about 6 or 8 months ago, I think. You can either reference it for me on your website, maybe it's there, or maybe you could go over it again for those of us who forget. The other question I have is I have a supposedly 60-40 split in my retirement from Spartan U.S. Equity and PIMCO Total Return. As you mentioned, the 500 indexes have not returned much, and, of course, the bond market has gone down. I guess what I'm looking to do is to switch that equity, that 500, into more of this couch potato that you were talking about.
Okay. All right. Well, let's do two things. One, I'm going to go over it very, very briefly. But, Jack, you have the website right there, and it's on the WILL website. Is that right?
It is. It's a little bit hard to find, and I'll try to make it easier. But if you go to the Focus 580 page on our website, there's a submenu that says links. And then there's a link to it from there. I think what I'll do is after the show, I'll put it on the schedule page that has this show, you know, this week's schedule, so that you see it next to David Sino's name.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
Well, essentially, when we look at an equity portfolio, and remember, this just the couch potato portfolio is just the dollars that you are allocating for equities.
Yes.
So I'm not talking about the 40 or 50 cents you're putting in fixed income.
Right.
But essentially, the way I have it set up is I've utilized a series of indexes. They happen to be available at Vanguard, but there's no magic there. These indexes are available elsewhere from other mutual fund companies as well. I put 10% of my money in the S&P 500. And 15% of my money in large value. So those are like S&P 500 companies, but they're selling on the cheap.
Okay.
They have a better relationship to book to price, and they're a little bit less expensive. That's large value. That's about 25%. I have also the Russell 2000 or the U.S. Small Company Index. That has 10%. And then I have small company value or small cap value, which is taking a percentage of those Russell 2000 companies that I call selling on the cheap again, and 15% of my money is allocated there. So now we've spent 50% of our money.
Uh-huh.
In addition, I like the mid-caps. The mid-caps are really the companies, if you look at the S&P 500, the first 100 are often referred to as the S&P 100, and then the next 400 are called the mid-caps. So that's a separate asset class. I also buy that asset class with 10% of my money. Finally, if I'm not heavy in real estate, if I'm not an outside real estate investor in the United States, then I want to be in some type of REIT index, and I'll put 10% of my money in a REIT index. If I already own a lot of real estate, then I'll reallocate that 10% among those other funds that I just mentioned. These REIT indexes will hold all kinds of companies. Some of these companies buy, sell, and manage shopping centers, hotels, warehouses, multifamily units, farmland, you name it, it's there. But I want some broad exposure to real estate at a reasonably inexpensive way of owning that real estate without having day-to-day active management. Okay? That takes me up to 70%. So 70% is U.S., 30% is international. And of that 30%, 20% I utilize the total international index from Vanguard, which is really, if you take a look at what's in it, it's three different funds of funds, which are Europe, Australia, the Far East, and the Asian corridor as well, and a partial amount in the emerging markets. So that's with 20 cents of my dollar. And then finally, and this is an aggressive play, and that is that 10% of my dollar are in the emerging markets. Those are countries like Brazil, Mexico, South Africa, India, China, some of the Asian corridor countries. So that's the emerging markets. It's a very volatile asset class. It can go up 25%. It can go down 25%. So you can't own it in a vacuum. You have to own it along with these other asset classes because, interestingly enough, even though it is very volatile, when you combine it with all of these other asset classes, you actually reduce the volatility of the overall portfolio. So that really is the couch potato portfolio. I know that Jack is going to update it, as I mentioned, through yesterday's close with all the hubbub on the stock market. The bottom line is it was up 6.82% through yesterday's close.
Could you address a little bit about the investing in bonds? Is it still wise to do that?
Well, as you know, in a rising interest rate environment, there's an inverse relationship between the direction of interest rates and the value of bonds. So as interest rates continue to move up, if you believe that interest rates are going to go up, then the value of bonds are going to go down, especially longer-term bonds. So I'm not real excited right now about long-term bonds because I'm concerned that the Federal Reserve is still going to raise interest rates. And until this inflation sort of cools, if we see some more numbers like this, it's impossible to predict those numbers, at least in my view. I don't have a crystal ball. But if you believe that inflation is going to continue, then the Federal Reserve is going to continue to raise interest rates by raising the Fed funds rate. When they do that, then interest rates in the environment get bid up and the value of bonds head south. So I don't like long-term bonds. Now, very, very short-term bonds, okay. Or alternatively, if you actually own the bond as opposed to owning the bond fund. Because remember, if you have a high-quality bond, you can hold the bond to maturity. And whether it goes up one day or down the next day, you don't really care because you're holding it for income. And at maturity, you get all of your principal back. So right now, what I really like, I like CDs. There's a lot of CDs out there in the 5 to 5.25%. They're typically brokered CDs, although locally in the Champaign-Urbana area, there are institutions paying at that same level. They'll match the national rates. So I think that's a very, very good play at the moment. But again, staying relatively short term. Does that help you?
Very much. Thank you very much.
Okay. A pleasure talking with you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for the call. We'll carry on next to another Champaign listener on line number two. Good morning.
Hi. I have a question that I think has a painfully obvious answer. I am going to be buying a house in a very depressed real estate market. In fact, it ranks 50th out of 51 among the states, 20% appreciation over 5 years. If you had $30,000 to put into, you know, some assets, of course, in a market like that, I probably would not want to put a ton into house equity. And, you know, you talk about diversification. I guess there's several issues here. I'd want to diversify into stocks and not put a lot into the house to reduce, say, my monthly payments. Is that correct?
Well, I think you want to, first of all, put enough into the house, regardless of what geographic locale you are in, to make certain that you qualify for a conventional loan.
I've already done that.
Okay, so you don't have any special insurance carrying costs that are required if you didn't have a conventional loan.
Correct.
And can you take advantage of an interest rate deduction on your tax return?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So then if you put 20% down and had a conventional 80% loan, I wouldn't have any problem with that. And if you had monies left over, I presume that if you were eligible, you would place $4,000 of leftover money into a Roth IRA.
Okay.
So that would be my first choice with an investment. Now, a Roth IRA, of course, is an investment vehicle, and you would go to a brokerage firm, a mutual fund, a bank.
I have one.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
So you're familiar with that, but that would be the next place. By the way, are you a first-time home buyer?
I'm going to be a first-time home buyer.
All right. Now, remember, as a first-time home buyer, how long have you had your Roth IRA?
I've had it for probably about 5 years.
Okay. Well, that's very interesting because under the Roth IRA rules, if you are a first-time home buyer, that you can access up to $10,000 of your money absolutely tax-free, including earnings on your Roth IRA, toward a down payment on a house. So I'm not suggesting that you do that, but that's an alternative source of funding for
that.
You. All right. Yeah. If you have outside cash, then put your 20% down and invest this money. But I would urge you to at least continue to put money in a Roth. Now, the real question is, all right, so I've got some additional money. Where do I invest it? Where do I invest it? I suppose that's what we're getting to.
Well, yeah, I just didn't want to, in a depressed market, I didn't know if I wanted to put, you know, if you had $30,000, you could put, you know, 30% down on a $100,000 house or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Or
mm-hmm.
would you want to, you know, put only, you know, 20% or 10% down? And,
well, let me ask you this. What interest rate are you gleaning on your mortgage?
It appears as if around 6.6.
Okay, 6.6, which is really basically about the market. And at 6.6, what tax bracket are you in? What marginal rate are you in?
I believe the 15. I'm not really sure. It's going to be a gross annual of about $50,000 a year.
Okay, are you a single taxpayer or are you a married taxpayer?
Married.
Okay, well, let me tell you that a married taxpayer, when that married taxpayer earns more than, well, I'm looking here, 61.3, has to be more than 61.3, you would then move up to the 25% tax bracket. So you're really in a 15% tax bracket.
I thought it was a 15.
Yeah. So you're really not getting a huge bang for your buck by itemizing on your tax return when we think about the interest factor here, because you're paying a net of 85% of the 6.6.
Right.
So 0.85 times 6.6 really is about 5.61 net.
Exactly.
And you need to do better than 5.61 net, or at least do something about 5.61 net. Should you be able to do that long term in markets? Yes, you should. Yes, you should. Should be able to do that. So that doesn't change my notion of getting a conventional loan 20% down and investing the difference and doing it in something that is liquid that you can get at. But if you're going to go into stocks or stock indexes, then you've got to be willing to do it over a long period of time.
Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Great answer.
Okay. Thanks for the call. Three callers waiting. We'll go on next to line number three, another Champaign listener. Good morning.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, my husband is the beneficiary of an annuity that he received outside the terms of a will, and the annuity has doubled in value since its inception. He has to take the proceeds within 5 years of the death of the benefactor. Already 2 years have elapsed, two or three. And the question is, do you have any suggestions for how to invest? He has to take it as a lump sum. How to invest that to minimize tax liability? There's still 2 years left before he has to take it.
Well, let me ask you a question because I'm a little bit unclear. I understand that this was an annuity product. I understand that your husband was the beneficiary.
Yes.
And I presume that the original annuitant, was it a related party?
No.
Okay.
No.
And was the beneficiary designation part of an IRA, or just simply was this just a separate annuity product where he is the beneficiary?
A separate annuity product.
Okay. Well, here's the bottom line. When he takes the money, he's going to have to pay ordinary income tax on that money. The difference between the cost basis of the amount of money that originally went into that annuity product, whatever that was, and what it's worth when you take that lump sum.
Yes.
That's going to be subject to ordinary income tax.
Okay.
There's really no way around that since he's the beneficiary under an estate plan. So what it's going to be added to your then marginal tax rate, and that's what's going to happen with it.
Mm.
All right?
Okay.
Well, you know, I'm sorry that this person passed away, but on the positive side, you're going to end up with some money even after tax on this matter.
Right.
And are you planning then, since you've probably elected to wait the 5-year period of time, are you planning then to not take the money for 5 years and just let the money continue to increase in value?
Well, I think that's what's sort of happening by default. I think there was a little bit of confusion in the beginning about whether it needed to be taken right away or this 5-year term. So it hasn't really been planned. I mean, it isn't necessary to keep it for the 5 years.
In other words. Well, I'm wondering if you'd worked with your estate planner and you had made an election for 5 years. You haven't made a formal written election.
No.
All right. So you have any time between now and the 5 years to essentially access that money.
Right.
And it may turn out you need to do some tax planning. And that is that since you know that this money is going to be added as ordinary income to your tax return, maybe when you take it, it's a good time to do charitable contributions, maybe double or triple up on 2 or 3 years of charitable contributions, et cetera, to bring down the tax impact of these annuity proceeds. So I would caution you and suggest to you that you get some advice from an accountant who can help you with some tax planning.
Okay. I appreciate the advice.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
We're past our midpoint this morning with David Sinnoh, professor of finance at the University of Illinois, our monthly guest on personal finance. Any questions you have are welcome. We have several lines full, but one open, 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Elsewhere, 800-222-9455. We have a listener in Moments on line number 4 next. Good morning.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning. I hope you comment on a policy question I have. I'm worried that the Federal Reserve Board is taking us into a stagflation situation like we had in the 1970s by raising interest rates, which when inflation is really caused by increasing price of oil. I'll hang up and listen to whatever comment you care to make.
Okay.
You know, I haven't thought a great deal about it, but we did reach that stagflation period. If you'll remember, I think that was under Gerald Ford when that happened. He started out with the win buttons. It was called whip inflation now, and by raising interest rates, and suddenly that policy sort of got reversed when the economy stopped expanding. So the listener is quite right to raise this issue. It has been raised by a number of commentators really over the last 6 to 12 months. Interestingly enough, the bond markets are signaling something completely different. And indeed, there was a very fascinating article in the Wall Street Journal, I believe it was yesterday. Up until about a week to 10 days ago, we had something called an inverted yield curve, which meant that you were better off in short-term treasuries than long-term treasuries. You were actually earning more money by staying short-term. Your interest rate of return was higher than in long-term. And when we typically have an inverted yield curve, historically, we have had the economy slow down. And that was sort of the theory that this was going to be the end of the Federal Reserve raising interest rates. Well, over the last 10 days with these inflation jitters, precisely the opposite has happened. That yield spread has actually widened. So now you are getting rewarded, if you will, for having a little bit longer-term maturities on the treasuries than shorter-term maturities. And what that is suggesting, and it's pretty good evidence, that the economy is still pretty darn strong. It's still moving forward. It's not contracting. It's expanding. And indeed, in the service sector particularly, it's been very strong and may indeed portend additional inflation. So at the moment, as for me, and I'm not an expert on this, but as for me, I don't see stagflation as the major problem on the highway, at least yet. I haven't seen enough indication of it. And indeed, recently, I've seen contraindications to the argument of stagflation.
Hope that gets to the question. Our lines are full. We'll continue here talking with listeners. Someone in Streeter, Illinois, line number one next. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. Quick question. I'm about 12 years from retirement and have about 70% of my investments actually are in farmland. And I read an article stating that if you had a lot of your investment in farmland or a fixed asset like that, that the rest of your investments you should put in a higher percentage in stock and stay away from fixed income investments because really your farmland is a fixed income investment. I just would like your opinion on that.
Well, clearly farmland over the last 4 or 5 years has been a phenomenal investment. And most people who've invested in farmland are indeed either farmers or agricultural folks themselves. A lot of that tremendous farmland appreciation has taken place as a result of exchanges taking place in the Chicago area, as you know, and pushing up the cost of farmland. So I feel rather comfortable, number one, in you owning the 70% of your portfolio in farmland, because I don't really see that phenomenon slowing down. As more and more development moves into the collar counties, people are selling land and looking for exchanges. So I think that obviously boosts the cost of farmland, but it makes it very, very expensive to come out if you were highly leveraged on farmland. But as far as an owner of farmland and either cash renting or whatever you're doing, I think it's a great investment. Now, the real question is, what do I do with my other 30%?
Correct.
The other 30%, I feel pretty comfortable if 2/3 of the other 30% were in stocks and 1/3 was in short-term fixed income.
Okay.
That would be my view of it. Then I think you would have a wonderful portfolio.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thanks for the call. Next up, someone in Bloomington, Indiana, line number two. Good morning.
Hi. Could you comment on what foreign stock markets knew that our stock market didn't know? Remember, our Federal Reserve raised the interest rates on the 10th of this month. They raised the interest rates another quarter point with the comment that they would watch economic evolution to determine future interest rate decisions. Our American markets shrugged it off. That day, it was a Wednesday, the 10th, after the Fed's decision, the Dow actually gained 3 points. But the foreign markets, that evening, they plunged. Tokyo first plunged, following the sun around the globe. Next, it was Europe. The European markets plunged. And the next morning, our stock futures were down hard. And you know what has happened since then. And what I'm asking is, could you tell us what the foreign stock markets knew that our stock market didn't know?
Well, the answer is I don't know. I don't know. It's a great question. I think when we talk about foreign stock markets and the returns that the foreign stock markets have earned, I think we can agree on one thing, that fundamentally when we look at the price to book or the price to earnings and we compared foreign stocks to U.S. stocks, foreign stocks were cheaper. All right?
Yeah.
That was the bottom line. And as a result, they had more room to run on the upside. Now, one of the things, of course, about foreign stocks is you've got a lot of currency risk that's involved in those foreign stocks, and that has to be factored in. And some of that appreciation that has occurred is a result of currency.
Yeah, they were investing. Well, they're investing in American Treasury notes, and they see the value of the American dollar declining.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so they know that the Federal Reserve is going to have to raise interest rates to protect our dollar
and make it more attractive for foreign investors to invest.
So they were more sensitive. Maybe they were more sensitive to the fact the Federal Reserve was going to raise interest rates again to protect the dollar, even maybe not directly in response to inflation.
Yeah, I'm not disagreeing with you. I don't know what goes through the heads of the people at the Fed, and you know how they talk.
Yeah.
Even after they talk, you can't figure out what they've said. But you can tell whether or not they've raised Fed funds rates. That we're pretty clear on.
Well,
and so I think your comments are well taken, and you may well be right.
There's another little problem that's bothering me. Could the Federal Reserve actually raise interest rates not to fight core inflation, but to slow economic growth for the purpose of reducing demand on commodities, reduce the demand for oil?
Yes, no question about it. And that's a policy that has been followed historically. Oh. That's not something new.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. To what extent is oil driving the inflationary pressure?
Well, no question about it, Jack. I mean, it's a big piece of the pie, and oil is so important to our economy in so many facets, both at the wholesale and the retail level, that when we're talking these kinds of prices for oil, it's obviously going to have a tremendous trickle-down effect. But what really is driving the commodity prices higher is the voracious appetite and now the competition for these basic materials among more than just the United States. We're talking about China and India, of course, that have this just tremendous appetite for steel, concrete, nickel, aluminum, copper, because they really are at that industrial revolution stage that we were at a long, long time ago. So imagine when we're talking about, what, over 2 billion people in those countries compared to 300 million in the United States, 7 times more people. How many more roads is that? How many more telephones is that? How many more buildings is that? So you can see this enormous competition for raw materials, and that's driving a great deal of the commodity prices. What's really worrying the Fed is that at the service level, prices are really jumping, and they're really concerned about that. And also at the retail level, the consumer price index, one of the major elements of the consumer price index are rents. I think it makes up somewhere between 35 and 40% of that basket of goods. And that is moving up rapidly in the United States. And that also is of grave concern to the Fed.
Very interesting. Well, we have several callers waiting. We'll go next to an Urbana caller, line number 3. Good morning.
David, I'd like to hear your comments on Scott Burns' News Gazette Sunday morning article, a brief paragraph. In 2005, the combined unfunded liabilities of Social Security and Medicare increased by $2.3 trillion, 7 times larger than the official 318 federal deficit. In 2006, they increased by an additional $3 trillion debt, 7 times larger again of the estimated $423 billion. And in 2 years, the Medicare and Social Security federal debt has increased by $5.3 trillion. That's more than the $5 trillion of federal debt. Thank you.
And what are we going to do about this crazy story? Because if you read the Social Security trustees report for 2005 that just came out, we have tremendous unfunded liabilities, as the caller just pointed out. $5 trillion pales. We're talking in Medicare alone, based upon the future promises that we've already been promised to all of our 65-year-old citizens and older. We're talking in the tens of trillions of dollars, and we're now going to compound that some more by this frighteningly complicated medical Part D program, which is the private pharmaceutical program that no one seems to understand. I'll be honest with you, I went on the website to sign up my mother, and even I had difficulty ferreting it out and figuring it out, and I'm reasonably intelligent, so we can imagine how difficult it is for most of our seniors. What's the solution? What is indeed the solution when we take Social Security and we take Medicare, which are the two largest entitlements, the two largest pieces of our budget, and we're looking at unfunded liabilities, more than $20 trillion based upon the promises we've made? And I'll be honest with you, I don't have a solution. but we better figure one out. I think I know some of the things that are going to happen. Number one, eventually, people who receive Social Security benefits, all of it is going to be subject to federal income tax. That's only a matter of time. I don't think there's any question about that. The wage base in Social Security, for purposes of figuring the 6.2% payroll tax, is going to move up much, much higher. Right now, it's limited to the CPI. So, for example, in 2006, it's based on about $94,000. That ceiling, it seems to me, is going to be taken off, just like it has been for Medicare. Because if you make a huge amount of money in salary or compensation in Medicare, you pay a 1.45% payroll tax on all of it. So I see some major changes that are going to come down. What's going to happen? We're going to have the fancy blue ribbon committee of Congress, whether it's a Democrat or Republican. Let's face it, there isn't a whole lot of difference when it comes to Social Security and Medicare. And they're going to have to get in there and do something, because the truth of the matter is that these programs today are spending more than $1 trillion. And we're running short. It's just simply hard to believe. So some big changes are coming down the road. And yes, the unfunded liabilities are so much larger that our actual deficit of $8 trillion pales in comparison to these unfunded liabilities. And Jack, I'm sure you could have a dozen shows about this problem.
Yeah, I'm sure we will as things unfold. We'll carry on here with some more questions from listeners. We have just about 10 minutes left with David Sinnoh, professor of finance, University of Illinois, talking about personal finance. And next up, someone in Rockford, line number four. Good morning.
Hello.
Yes.
Thanks for taking my call. I have a question that involves IRA distribution and capital gains on selling timber. The situation is I'm 69 years old and have about $110,000 in IRA that will have to be distributed according to the minimum amount according to the law. And also we have some timber land on some family farmland, which I'm probably going to sell this year. I'm going to sell the trees off the land. So I think that'll be a capital gain, and I'm probably going to have around $100,000 worth of trees sold.
Wow, what kind of trees are these?
They're walnut, oak, and maple.
Oh, boy. Okay.
And I'm right now paying tax in the income tax near the top end of the 15% bracket.
Well, you're going to move a little bit higher, probably.
Yeah, but what's the tax rate going to be on the capital gains for this timber, these trees that are sold?
Well, number one, I would suggest that you contact your accountant. Do you work with an accountant?
I have not so far.
Well, I think before you sell the trees that you need to work with an accountant to make certain the way it's handled that you will receive capital gains treatment and it will not be taxed as ordinary income. And I'm not an expert on taking trees off of land and whether or not you can treat that as a capital gains item, which is a tax preference item, which would be taxed at either 15, perhaps as high as 20%, or alternatively, that it's going to be treated as ordinary income and kick you up to the 25% tax bracket. That's just a question. It's a very interesting intellectual question. I'm sorry, I just don't know the answer, but any accountant who has any salt at all will know that answer, and I would urge you, before you enter into a sale for that timberland and take any proceeds, that you know precisely the tax impact and whether there's a better way of doing it. All right? That's number one. Number two, remember, you're not quite 70 and a half yet. So you don't have to take any money out of your IRA. I presume this is a traditional IRA.
Yes.
Which meant that all of the money that's in it is really tax deferred, and when it comes out, it will be subject to federal income tax.
That's right.
All right. So you can wait until 70 and a half, and then you have to take a minimum distribution. Actually, the rule says you can wait till April 1 following the year you reach 70 and a half, but most people just take it when they reach 70 and a half, which really does make sense. Are you married?
Yes.
Okay. Well, believe it or not, this is not going to be too burdensome because you get to amortize that over a long, long period of time. And the truth of the matter is that the first year distribution is going to be between 3 and 4% of the previous year-end balance. So let's just say that the year-end balance of next year is $115,000. If you multiply that times about 3.75%, you'd be in the neighborhood of about $4,000, maybe $4,500 that you would have to take out. And in fact, in the early years, you may actually have your IRA go higher even after you have taken your minimum distribution. So I wouldn't be too concerned about that. I'm much more concerned that you handle your timber transaction correctly. And that involves $150 or $200 of advice from an accountant. Spend the $200 with the accountant to save yourself thousands of dollars in tax.
Yeah, I've been studying the federal income tax pamphlets on timber sales, and also there's some legislation now on capital gains tax going on right now in Congress, I think, about reducing it to 5% or 0% or something like that.
Well, that depends basically on your marginal tax bracket to begin with. And I don't think you'll, based upon what you're telling me, I don't think that's going to apply to you. Okay?
Yeah, all right. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Call.
Sure.
We have just about 5 minutes left. We'll try to get our callers, remaining callers in. Next up, someone in Champaign, line number one. Good morning.
Hello. Mm-hmm. This is kind of a life dream question. I'll try to keep it short and not frivolous. The idea is spending a year in another country, but I have a house that I would want to do something with. So I have a question about, A, are we really in the midst of a housing crash? B, even if we are or aren't, is it a good idea to sell your house when you would want to go somewhere else for a year, or should you try to rent it instead? What are the tax consequences? And if you do sell it, what's the best thing to do with the money?
Number one, I would not recommend selling the house if you are simply going to be gone for a year, because when you come back, you'll want another house, and the transaction costs on both sides of the deal will eat you up.
Okay.
You've got a real estate commission going out, and then you're, even though the seller, when you're buying back, is paying the real estate commission, believe me, it's built into the sale. So between new loans, new real estate commissions, transaction costs, doesn't make a lot of sense. Whether or not you want to be an absentee landlord, that's up to you. Some people are very happy with it. Some people aren't. If you have a nice house and you price it reasonably, you typically can find a very, very nice tenant who will take care of it for you and not beat it up. You'll want a lease. You'll want security deposits, probably no pets, etc., so you don't come back and have a, well, shall we say, a big surprise. You might even consider contacting a local management firm who are professionals in this matter, because when you're abroad, the last thing you want is a telephone call about the water heater breaking, right? So it might make some sense to entertain the notion of having professional management take care of this, rent it for you, and look after it.
Okay. How much would a firm like that typically charge? Let's say your mortgage is $800 a month, and how much would the – I guess I want to know how much you would have to charge to pay taxes on profit if it's called profit, and how much you have to make to, you know, pay the firm.
Well, for a one-year period of time, you would report all of the income as income. You still would be able to deduct your interest and your real estate taxes. So you probably wouldn't have much of an impact in terms of income. And a firm would certainly charge at least 10% of the gross rent. So if you rented the house for $1,000 a month for 11 or 12 months, you could figure that they certainly would be entitled to 10%. And they indeed would if they do a good job for you while you are abroad.
Right.
So that's sort of a touchstone.
Thanks.
Okay, my pleasure.
Thank you. About 3 minutes left. We'll go to someone in Champaign, line number three. Good morning.
Yes, hello. I have a question about an Illinois zero coupon general obligation called savings bond that I bought in 1988. It is coming due on August the 1st. I'm wondering if there is a secondary market that it trades in that I might be able to make some money selling it that way. And indeed, when it comes time for me to have to redeem it, where would you suggest I do it? The firm where I bought it, a bank, are there any other alternatives? And if you have time, what would you do with the money?
Well, number one, when it comes due on August 1, you can take it to the firm if you hold it in certificate form And basically, they'll send it in for you, and there should be little or no transaction costs. So I wouldn't worry about that. Number two, I've looked at zeros myself, and really, most of them are getting priced almost to that point of maturity. So you're already in May, and you really don't have a lot of arbitrage play, especially with interest rates moving up. A year, year and a half ago, you probably could have made some additional money. But today, it would have been very, very difficult. The good news is that when you get the money, it's tax-free money. That's the positive part. And then I presume maybe you're using it for college education.
No,
if not, well, if not, then you might be looking at reinvesting it in fixed income, perhaps even in certificates of deposit at that point in time.
There would not be anyone who would want to use it for college fund that would be willing to pay any more for it now or that would want to buy it directly?
No, don't think so. Don't think so. You're just too close to maturity.
All right. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Okay. Thanks for the call. We'll try to squeeze in our last caller here. We're going to have to be really quick, though. Line number two, good morning.
Hello.
Yes. Yes.
What strategies would you suggest for taking money out of 403Bs?
Well, basically, you want a dollar cost average out of your 403B. A lot of people do it by taking a minimum distribution. Are you at a minimum distribution age?
Yes, I will be soon.
Okay, so you can take either the minimum distribution or more than the minimum distribution. Were you thinking of taking more or less or just the minimum distribution?
Well, I was thinking perhaps of more. I don't need to take it out. What I'd like to do is protect myself against, actually be my heirs against big tax bite when it does come out in a big chunk.
Well, that's certainly possible because remember, if you take it out, pay the income tax now, you could gift it out of your estate, or depending upon the size of your estate, with after-tax money, you may have no estate tax at all. Currently, if your estate is less than $2 million, there wouldn't be any estate tax. So I would suggest that you consult with a tax advisor to see what makes the most sense.
Okay. I'm sorry to say we'll have to stop there because we're simply out of time, but I will promise folks that we'll update the webpage on the WILL site with David Sinnoh's Couch Potato Portfolio. That's right. And so that'll be up there on the Focus schedule page and also on the links page next to Focus 580. Our guest, David Sinnoh, professor of finance, University of Illinois. As always, thanks so much.
Thanks so much. It was lots of fun.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign. Locally owned and operated and serving families since 1925. The staff at Owens Funeral Home invite you to join them in supporting public radio. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Radio Maria in downtown Champaign, with an international brunch, lunch, and dinner menu influenced by Caribbean, Asian, Indian, Spanish, and Latin cuisines. Radio Maria now features Sunday dinner with a different and unique menu every week.
That's it for this hour, Focus 580. We return in just about 10 minutes.